This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. I'm not sure any serious novelist working today has Nicholson Baker's talent for generating controversy, or controversy of such variety. His last novel was about a reasonable man's assassination plot against President Bush. In a nonfiction book called Double Fold, Baker accused the librarians of America of high crimes for throwing out their old collections of newspapers. But those dust-ups were nothing compared to Nicholson Baker's new nonfiction book. It's a revisionist history, extremely revisionist, of the prelude and beginnings of World War II. The book is called Human Smoke, The Beginnings of World War II, The End of Civilization. Welcome.
Well, pleased to be here. Thanks.
The end of civilization, meaning what exactly? I didn't get the memo about civilization ending.
What I was trying to go for with that was just that what happened right there in the middle of the 20th century that suspended all the normal rules and restraints of civilized behavior. Why did we get to the point where countries could do such barbarous things to themselves and to each other? It wasn't an end, a permanent end.
Right.
Obviously, it was a hiatus.
We dropped off a cliff, but obviously in the case of the Holocaust, but in total war in general.
Exactly. And the question is, why? How did that happen? What were the tiny steps that led to us jumping off that cliff?
Your source material is pretty unusual for a work of history and interesting from the reader's point of view. Lots of clips from the New York Times, Time magazine, from the 1920s and 30s. This is a long run-up. Was that your strategy from the beginning, to not so much go to the existing World War II literature in books, but to sort of see how it was being discussed in the vignettes and anecdotes from the press?
Yes, because I'd had to take care of a lot of newspapers. I knew that there were interesting things that were just sitting there on the front page that were hiding in plain sight. And I found, oddly enough, that sometimes the report, let's say, of the bombing of Coventry that was written the day after was taught me more about what had happened than the book about. There's several books about the bombing of Coventry. It's not that those aren't good, and I use those as well. It's just that when somebody writes about something the day after it happened, Everything is in a certain balance and proportion that is true to the time.
Uh-huh.
And that's the usefulness of following the sources.
At 7:10 p.m., German Pathfinder planes arrived over the target. They dropped 10,000 incendiaries in the first half hour. The bombing continued until dawn. The central part of the city was destroyed. 500 people died. 50,000 houses were damaged. The tower and some of the walls of the cathedral were left standing amid the obliteration. All the shops, Boots, Flynn's the Jewelers, Mark's, Woolworth's, all along and down Smithford Street, gone. Not a shop standing. A reporter for the German propaganda ministry who flew in one of the bombers wrote, "It looked as if the earth had broken open and spewed fiery masses of lava far over the land."
The book is barely in bookstores, and already it's attracting attention and, as I said, controversy. I'm going to quote from a review in the conservative magazine, I guess you could call it, Commentary. The reviewer says, "By treating history as though he were writing a novel, Baker is able to dispense with context and select solely whatever material he can find to substantiate his one predetermined conclusion, that the Allies were as bad as the Axis and civilization was the loser." Now, in my reading of the book, you did not explicitly argue that the Allies were as bad as the Axis, but what is your conclusion in 75 words or less?
Well, I think that's a not a fair characterization of the book. It's so easy to say that there's a demonic evil force in Germany, Hitler, and he's doing bad things, and therefore any person or any government who resists this force must be doing good things.
Uh-huh.
In history, it doesn't work that way. Some of the decisions that Winston Churchill made were savage and brutal as well.
"We have differed and quarreled in the past."
Here's Winston Churchill in the fall of 1940.
"Now one bond unites us all, to wage war until victory is won, and never to surrender ourselves to servitude and shame, whatever the cost and the agony may be.
And is it your view that a acceptable, if not equally good, conclusion to World War II could have been achieved with much less loss of life if not for the bring-it-on bellicosity of Churchill?
I will say that it couldn't have worked out worse than it did, that the war was a complete catastrophe and killed many people, and that there must have been, and there were, I think, junctures, moments of decision where a less militaristic approach would have worked better.
If say, and so long as we're speculating about counterfactual histories, if Britain and the United States would have said, okay, Adolf Hitler, continental Europe, it's yours, stay there, we'll let you do what you will. And if he'd bought that and hadn't continued beyond Europe, would a Nazi Europe have been a better conclusion, you think, than how it actually went down?
The real question is, are you supposed to look at Hitler as if he's some kind of perpetual motion machine who, in overrunning Europe, will live forever? Or do you look at him as a middle-aged, insane person? If you look at him as an insane person holding hostages, then you have to ask yourself, is the right response to this person to shoot out his windows and try to set fire to his building? Is that the response that's going to actually help save the hostages? And I think that the book doesn't answer that question,
right?
Because I'm not interested in trying to answer the question, but I just think it's worth asking the question.
Do you know anybody who fought in World War II?
No, and I think that one of the things that made me hesitate as I was working on the book was to think that a lot of people did heroic things, suffered, were injured, believed in this cause. And I am writing a book that, although it doesn't say it overtly, is an argument for a different way of looking at the war, that the fighting of the war was part of the whole disaster. And I'm sorry to have concluded that, because I want heroism to be possible, but it just doesn't seem to me that the people who fought in the war, that their talents, their energies, their emotions were used to any good effect.
To any good, but when you say any good effect, I mean that's where I sort of come up short. You know, I mean we could disagree about the cost benefit of this many lives worth this much human freedom. But certainly there was good effect.
If you look at the whole Second World War, Kurt, you think that there's good effect there. I just don't see it. I don't see it. There were many heroic flights into Germany and heroic flights by German pilots into Britain. And then there was a massive land war. And meanwhile, there were millions of civilians dying. And I just can't see that any part of that is in any way good. I just can't be convinced of that.
Someone asked Gandhi about English pacifists. It was May 1938. The problem with the English pacifists, Gandhi said, was that they made moral calculations. When they speak of pacifism, they do so with the mental reservation that when pacifism fails, arms might be used. A true pacifist never calculated. Someone has to arise in England with a living faith to say that England, whatever happens, shall not use arms. That will be a real miracle.
The point of having a figure like Gandhi in there is to say that was there a different, not an absolute pacifism, but a willingness to negotiate, a willingness to find some less... less fatal way was, and in fact, what he was saying was, is a vast military response to Hitler, will that in fact possibly, he said this and I quote him, would that possibly bring about as a first reaction a massacre of the people who are the most subjected group in Germany, and that was the Jews. So in some ways, Gandhi was, in fact, a prescient historian, as well as being an extreme pacifist and a saintly figure.
So I take it you probably think that this standard story we tell ourselves about World War II drives our current geopolitical military policy.
Well, I just think you can't bomb niceness and civility into people. It doesn't work. And what the Second World War teaches you is that you can't do that, that it actually has the opposite effect.
Well, in the short term, but in the long term, Europe is a very civil and nice place.
Yes, that's true. In the long term, regimes change and people die and all that. But in the short term, things falling from the sky and blowing up buildings or airplanes flying into buildings create a rage reaction. Mm-hmm. And the first response to that is extreme xenophobia. And people are put into prisons and are treated badly. And there's a kind of a rippling through of hatred in a society. And that when things blow up from the sky.
Right.
And that's the lesson of the Second World War. And that's the lesson of 9/11. And it's the lesson of Iraq.
Are you prepared for the onslaught of spittle and vitriol and anger and upset that this is going to provoke?
I don't think that there will be such an onslaught of spittle and
really
vitriol.
Let's talk again in a few months.
Well, I of course there will be, but what I think that the book that there a legitimate response to reading this book is to come to a totally different conclusion than the ones that I have said here. Mm-hmm. I'm telling you that in working on the book, I reached these tentative conclusions about the logic of the war. But I will acknowledge that sensitive and thoughtful people will come to an entirely different
right.
conclusion, which is that we had to
right.
resist Hitler in this particular military way involving all these airplanes. I mean, I would listen to them eagerly. I would want to be convinced.
Nicholson Baker, thank you very much.
Thanks, Kurt.
Nicholson Baker's new book is called Human Smoke. What do you think of Baker's ideas about World War II? If you'd like to tell us, go to the comments page at studio360.org. In fact, feel free to comment about anything you heard on the show today. And while you're at the website, you can subscribe to the podcasts of our show or sign up for our newsletter so you'll know what's coming up every week in advance. I'm Kurt Anderson, and I want to thank you very much for listening today, and I hope you'll join us again next week. Studio 360 is produced by WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Julie Burstein, Lital Mulad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Pike Medinowski,
Sarah Lilly,
Katie Rolnick,
Andrea Salenzi,
and Nat Wiener.
And our theme music is by David Van Tiegum.
PRI's Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees, by the Lilly Auchincloss Foundation, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
What's cuter, puppies?
Oh, you're too adorable.
Or pouty, curly-haired children?
Lollipop. I frankly found it repulsive. I mean, I said, really? I mean, it's just a dog.
I'm Kurt Anderson. Join me with the Penn State Professor of Cute next time in Studio 360 from PRI.